Intravenous bisphosphonate therapy has had a remarkably positive impact on the natural history of a variety of tumors in the metastatic setting. And while this treatment strategy has had an overwhelmingly positive benefit-risk ratio, there are uncommon potential complications to this management strategy. I met with Dr. Alan Lipton, a medical oncologist who's taken a leadership role in this important area, and he began by providing a brief history of critical developments in the field, and specifically how the use of bisphosphonates have changed the natural history of a variety of common tumors.
Bisphosphonates are analogs of a naturally occurring compound, pyrophosphate, which is a POP backbone. The bisphosphonate backbone is PCP, so there's an alteration of the middle oxygen with a carbon moiety. Now, historically, bisphosphonates were made in the late 1890s into the early part of the 20th century by companies that were using bisphosphonates as toothpaste additives and soap additives and preservatives. So in this country, P&G was one of the leaders in that area. There were a number of European companies who used bisphosphonates for that purposes. The medicinal uses of bisphosphonates really started in about 1965 when a Swiss biochemist realized that bisphosphonates would hook onto bone. They were attracted to the hydroxyapatite in bone. And then they put two and two together and said, well, if they hook onto bone, maybe they can inhibit bone resorption. And they began to do some in vitro and animal studies and showed that bisphosphonates did indeed hook onto the bisphosphonate in bone and inhibit osteoclast function and prevented bone resorption. The next step historically after that was to begin to use bisphosphonates to treat situations of rapid bone resorption. So there was a movement of use of bisphosphonates in the osteoporosis world where they become the mainstay of therapy. Ever since that time, there was the first pioneering studies of the use of bisphosphonates to treat hypercalcemia of malignancy and showed that bisphosphonates could decrease the high serum calcium in malignancy of hypercalcemia. And then a number of early phase two studies were done in patients with bone metastasis, and those studies with the first generation bisphosphonate, clodronate, showed that there was pain relief in patients with metastatic bone disease, and then fracture studies began and showed that the rate of fracture and so-called skeletal-related events could be decreased with the use of bisphosphonate therapy. So it's been an interesting journey, really, over 100 years, or certainly the last 40 years in the patients with cancer.
Can you kind of bring us up to date on some of the new developments in terms of bone and cancer?
Let's start with a definition of skeletal-related events and the studies that were done with pimidronate, which were the initial studies. You had to define endpoints of treatment of bisphosphonates in patients with metastatic cancer to bone. The endpoints that were designed in those studies were to look at SREs. Now, an SRE was a fracture of bone, the need for surgery to bone, the need for radiation therapy to bone, and hypercalcemia. So we needed to decide, were you looking at a drug that would decrease pain, which could be one endpoint? Were you looking at a drug that could retard the rate of skeletal-related events? Or were you looking at a drug that could prolong survival? Were you looking at a drug that could prevent progression of cancer to new sites in bone? There were a number of endpoints that could be looked at in the cancer studies. In the pimidronate studies of the 1980s, early 1990s, it was chosen that this was not a narcotic. We wouldn't look only at pain. We would look at pain, but it wouldn't be the primary endpoint. The primary endpoint would be the rate and number of SREs and the percent of patients who experienced an SRE. Now, in terms of background and incidence, we know that this year in the United States, there'll be 400,000 newly diagnosed patients with bone metastasis. We also know, and that's most of those people will have breast cancer metastatic to bone, prostate cancer metastatic to bone. 3/4 of the patients who develop metastatic disease from breast or prostate cancer will have skeletal involvement. We know that 1/3 of the patients with lung cancer and approximately 1/3 of the patients with kidney cancer who develop metastatic disease will have disease involving the skeleton. And we also know from the studies that were done, the placebo arm of the pimidronate trials and the placebo arm of the zoledronic acid trials, we know that each patient who develops bone metastasis will have on the order of one skeletal event every 3 or 4 months prior to the use of bisphosphonate. So skeletal involvement is enormously common, and skeletal-related events are terribly common in this patient population.
What are some of the new developments in terms of management of these problems?
We've gone through a couple of generations of bisphosphonate trials. The first studies with pimidronate were done in patients with breast cancer and multiple myeloma, and the design of those trials was pimidronate versus placebo. What pimidronate did was it decreased the rate of skeletal-related events by about 30% compared to placebo. It also decreased the rate at which pain would worsen in those patients. There was some suggestion of a decrease in narcotic usage and maybe a slight improvement using the indices of performance status, which were older indices at that point in time. So around 1992, pimidronate was approved for the use in patients with breast cancer and multiple myeloma. Ciba Geigy, now Novartis, the company that makes that drug, went to the FDA and asked for a broad approval for all patients with bone metastasis. They did not get it. The agency said, go back and study the drug in prostate cancer and other solid tumors. At that time, the newer, more potent bisphosphonate zoledronic acid was coming into clinical trials. So what they did with zoledronic acid was they tested it in three different studies across the board. The first study was in patients with breast cancer and multiple myeloma. And there was a head-on comparison of the new drug, zoledronic acid, versus the older drug, pimidronate. The second study was in prostate cancer, and the design of that was zoledronic acid monthly versus placebo. The third study was in other solid tumors, lung cancer, half the patients in renal cell and other diseases that go to bone, and the design of that study was zoledronic acid versus placebo. Now let's go back to the first study, the breast cancer myeloma study. In multivariate analysis, or so-called Anderson-Gill multi-event analysis, zoledronic acid decreased the rate of events by 20% compared to the older drug, pimidronate. In prostate cancer compared to placebo, the decrease in the rate of skeletal-related events was about one-third, and in other solid tumors, the rate of events comparing zoledronic acid to placebo was decreased by about a third. So given those three studies, given the superiority of the newer, more potent third-generation bisphosphonate, that got the FDA approval for the broad indication of all malignancies. I should mention also that the effectiveness of both pimidronate and zoledronic acid is quite high in hypercalcemia malignancy. In the head-on comparison, the first study that was done, zoledronic acid is superior to pimidronate in treatment of hypercalcemia malignancy. A greater percentage of patients normalized their serum calcium, and the duration of normalization of serum calcium was much longer with zoledronic acid than it was with pimidronate.
Do we know how these agents have affected sort of the face of metastatic disease, particularly metastatic breast cancer? And it seems like, you know, 10, 15 years ago, maybe longer, there were lots of patients in the hospital with hypercalcemia and really bad complications.
Yes. These drugs have dramatically changed the, as you put it, Neil, the face of metastatic bone disease. So in years gone by, I think you and I remember, it was not infrequent for a patient to suffer toward the end of their illness from hypercalcemia malignancy. We used to teach the fellows and the residents and the students that at some point in their disease, 10 to 20% of patients with metastatic bony involvement would develop hypercalcemia, usually within 3 months of their demise. Now it's a pretty rare event for a patient to have hypercalcemia, and it's quite rare for me to see a patient on rounds in the hospital with hypercalcemia malignancy. In similar fashion, it was not uncommon for a patient to be in the hospital on the orthopedic service with a pathologic fracture, transfer from my service, oncology service, to the orthopedic service because of a broken bone. We know, again, that the rate of fracture has been significantly decreased by somewhere between 30 and 50% with the widespread use of bisphosphonate. So I think we've dramatically changed the face of patients with metastatic bone disease and the complications thereof and the attendant cost, decreased performance status, decreased quality of life. And there are some interesting studies recently that have been done similar to what has been shown in osteoporosis, that if you can prevent fractures, you can improve survival. And it's been shown recently that in prostate cancer and in multiple myeloma and breast cancer, that if you can prevent fractures, you can improve survival. And bisphosphonates appear to do all of that.
Where are we in our understanding of side effects and complications from these therapies?
That's a most important question. What are the toxicities of bisphosphonates? Well, they're pretty well tolerated compared to many chemotherapeutic agents that we routinely use. The major side effects that have been seen with bisphosphonates can be broken into two groups of side effects. The first are the so-called acute phase reactions, so that we know within 24 or 48 hours of administering an intravenous bisphosphonate, maybe a third to a half of the patients will experience an increase in temperature, low-grade fever, which is usually self-limited and treated easily with Tylenol. A number of patients will have exacerbation of bone pain, so they'll have arthralgias and increasing pain and treated with narcotics, and they usually diminish over, as I said, 24 to 48 hours. They're usually associated with the first dose of bisphosphonate, so on subsequent doses, second, third, fourth dosage, you don't see them as much. And the reason for the acute phase reaction has been worked out by some lovely biochemical work of Mike Rogers in England and several other investigators, and it looks like bisphosphonates, through their inhibition of the mevalonate pathway, can increase the number of gamma delta T cells, and that causes outpouring of cytokines from the gamma delta T cells, and that causes the acute phase reaction. Now, there are some other longer-term side effects that are more serious. So we know that all bisphosphonates that are given in a high enough dose over a shorter and shorter period of infusion will cause renal toxicity. They'll cause glomerular tubular damage, depending on which bisphosphonate one uses. So we've learned that you need to do renal monitoring every month before a bisphosphonate dose. The label of zoledronic acid says that you ought not to give a bisphosphonate for creatinine above 3 or a significant decrease in urinary creatinine clearance. And I think that's now routinely done in clinical practice. The usage of higher doses of zoledronic acid, up to 8 milligrams every month, was cut short because of renal toxicity when given over a short period of time. So we don't do that anymore. The third complication, which has gotten a lot of press recently, is the incidence of osteonecrosis of the jaw, which was not previously recognized with oral bisphosphonates, although it does occur at a low rate with oral bisphosphonates for osteoporosis. And it was not recognized in the 3,000 patients' large phase 3 studies of zoledronic acid, and it certainly was not recognized in the database with pimidronate. It was recognized in 2003 by two oral surgeons, Bob Marks in Miami and Dr. Ruggiero at Long Island Jewish Hospital. They, in their oral surgical practices, had an influx of patients with ONJ and reported this in the literature. Now, what we know about osteonecrosis of the jaw is from two large retrospective studies. The first one done at Sloan Kettering by Kathy Van Posnak. She went through, I believe, 600 records at Sloan Kettering of ONJ in patients treated with bisphosphonates, and she found an incidence of ONJ in the order of 0.6% in people. The average duration of bisphosphonate use in that retrospective study was on the order of 52 months. There's been some recent data from Ann Hoff at MD Anderson that was reported this spring. Again, a retrospective review of the data from MD Anderson Hospital, over 4,000 patients. And there, the incidence of ONJ was 0.8% overall. It was on the order of 1% for breast cancer patients. It seems to be slightly higher in multiple myeloma patients, and the Anderson experience was on the order of 2%, again, with long-term uses. The outlier in terms of incidence is from Professor Demopoulos in Greece, who reports in the Greek experience an incidence of ONJ around 7 or 8%. I think in this country, the incidence is probably around 1%. We've now learned that it's a real phenomenon. It's probably associated with bisphosphonate usage. It's probably associated with zoledronic acid use. It appears to be more common the longer you use the drug, but it's still in the order of 1%. People are required to have a good dental examination before institution of bisphosphonate therapy. If they need dental surgery, get it done before you start a bisphosphonate. If a patient requires dental surgery on the bisphosphonate, we don't know how long to stop it, but most of us are stopping it 1 or 2 months before the dental surgery and then reinstituting it when the dental surgery has healed. Decision that the individual physician needs to make is you need to weigh the significant benefit of bisphosphonates in terms of close to a 50% decrease in the risk of an SRE versus the 1% risk of ONJ. Right now, we have good data out to 2 years with use of bisphosphonates. We don't have clinical trials of the use of bisphosphonate beyond 2 years, so it becomes an individual patient decision. What I do personally is if I have a patient who's at high risk with extensive amount of bone disease, and has had significant SREs in the past, then I might continue the bisphosphonate beyond the 2 years. If not, I think it's up to the individual doctors to decide what to do at that point.
Can you talk about the mechanism involved with the ONJ, the clinical presentation and management?
I think we really don't know the ultimate mechanism of ONJ. There are a couple of hypotheses. One hypothesis is that the jaw, especially the mandible, which is where most of the ONJ cases do occur, is a bony structure, and it receives a lot of insults, infection, trauma, and it needs to heal in, and that's an osteocyte-driven phenomenon. Second possible mechanism of ONJ, which has been speculated on, is that it turns out that the mandible, the jaw, is a very vascular structure, and it may well be that angiogenesis is necessary to keep our mandible healthy. And bone is not a static structure. Bone is a very dynamic structure, which is always turning over. So you need new osteocytes brought in. You need remodeling at all times to keep bone healthy. You need perhaps blood vessels bringing in nutrients and nutrition to keep the bone healthy. Now, bisphosphonates can interfere with that process in two ways. Bisphosphonates are attracted to hydroxyapatite in bone, so they hook onto bone, and they're slowly released from the hydroxyapatite in bone into the bone marrow microenvironment, where they're taken up by osteoclasts. And they're very strong osteoclast poisons. They inhibit FBP synthase, which is part of the mevalonate pathway in osteoclasts, and they induce apoptosis in osteoclasts. They prevent the maturation of precursor hematopoietic cells to mature osteoclasts. So basically, they're osteoclast poisons, and they kill the cells that may be involved in bone remodeling. So if you have trauma or infection and you don't have active osteoclasts, you may not heal in, and that leads to the non-healing ulcers that we call osteonecrosis of the jaw. The other possible mechanism is there's a lot of data showing that bisphosphonates not only have anti-osteoclast activity, but they have anti-angiogenic activity. There are a number of studies out of Italy showing in animal model systems of angiogenesis that bisphosphonates at high enough concentrations are anti-angiogenic. Now, in the bone, where they're pulling in bisphosphonates and concentrating it in there, it may well be that there's an anti-angiogenic activity going on in the mandible, and that could lead to the non-healing ulcer. So we've got two potential mechanisms, and we don't know which is occurring.
Can you talk about the clinical presentation and management of ONJ?
I've only seen three cases in my experience, but ONJ presents with one of two clinical presentations. One would be a non-healing ulcer over the mandible or maxilla, and the other would be pain in that area, pain in the jaw associated frequently with an ulceration. So I think we're trying to define criteria for ONJ. Some people say you need to have a non-healing ulcer for 3 months. Some people say you need to have a non-healing ulcer for 2 months. But it's basically pain and non-healing and of an ulcer, or a non-healing ulcer is what we now call ONJ, an exposed bone under that ulcer.
How often is that associated with some type of a dental problem?
ONJ is frequently in the cancer population, looking at the literature, associated with a dental problem. It's more frequently associated with dental surgery in patients who are receiving bisphosphonate therapy. But there are reports, and we've seen cases of spontaneous non-healing in of jaw ulcers in the absence of dental surgery. I think the red flag would be doing dental surgery, extensive dental surgery, on a patient on bisphosphonate therapy.
This may seem like a naive question, but how do you define dental surgery? I mean, a tooth extraction, gum surgery,
yeah,
any of those?
I'm not sure I can definitively answer that. It's certainly not drilling into a tooth and putting in a filling in that situation. I think I would define it, but I'm not a dental surgeon. I would define it as any surgery that begins to cut into the tissues above the jawbone. I think I'd begin to worry if a dental surgeon told me that he needed to do it. And we always tell our patients to please inform us before they have any dental surgery, then I'd call the oral surgeon. And if he's planning to do any cutting into the gums under the tooth over the mandible and maxilla, I would ask him if it's absolutely necessary or whether he can delay it for any period of time. Because remember, these are people with metastatic bone disease, and many of them are not going to live very many years. So unless it's absolutely necessary, I would avoid dental surgery of the nature that I mentioned in these people.
What's done in terms of management?
There are a number of patients who've had infectious processes in these non-healing ulcers. So one thing that you'd want your oral surgeon, I think they're actinomycetes. One thing you'd want to do is have your dental surgeon do cultures and see if there's an infectious etiology of that non-healing ulcer. Because remember, there are a number of causes of what we call osteonecrosis of the jaw. If you go back through the literature, there are patients who receive chemotherapy who are reported to have ONJ. There are patients who receive radiation therapy. They're few and far between. But there are patients reported with radiation therapy in the jaw area who've had ONJ as a result of that. And certainly infection is something that you should think of and rule out as a causation of ONJ. If that's not the case, then I think we really don't yet know exactly how to manage it. Certainly, many physicians, and myself included, would stop the bisphosphonate and not institute it unless you really felt the benefit outweighed any further risk. There are some physicians who say, well, we don't have any data, I'm just going to continue the bisphosphonate through that, but I think I'd be a little leery of doing that. There are some studies looking at other techniques, such as hyperbaric oxygen, to see if you can accelerate healing, but I think you're looking at a relatively new phenomenon. We don't have any good prospective studies. I think the bottom line is we really don't know how best to handle it. The one thing that does come out through the literature and speaking to oral surgeons is that surgery to try to heal it and cover it over is not effective. So you ought to try to avoid any further dental surgery and use more conservative measures. And sometimes it'll heal, not always. My impressions of the literature is that you'll get complete healing in maybe a third of the time. So it's a major problem in those people in whom it occurs.
So you're saying in many patients it doesn't get better?
In some patients it doesn't heal in. They have protracted non-healing ulcers, which in some people can be quite painful. So it's a problem you'd like to try to avoid. In some people it will heal, but not in all.
Where are things heading in the field?
The field of the treatment of bone metastasis is, I think, in its relative infancy and has been somewhat ignored in oncologic circles. But I think we're headed into a very exciting era in a couple of ways. The first is that there are some studies using the first generation bisphosphonate clodronate. There are two studies, one by Ingo Diehl in Hamburg, Germany, and one by Trevor Powles in London and Sandy Patterson in Calgary, suggesting that adjuvant clodronate, in addition to usual adjuvant therapies, can prevent bone metastasis and prolong survival. There's one negative study by Tina Sardo in Finland using adjuvant clodronate, which showed just the opposite, a higher rate of metastasis. But there were imbalances in that study, so that's an imperfect study. So that's headed into a large NSABP study, B34, which is accrued over 2,400 patients, and we're waiting for events to occur to see if it turns out that this large NSABP study can confirm the two smaller studies, the Diehl and the Powles-Patterson study. That study, Sandy Patterson told me this week, will hopefully report in the year 2008. The second study, which has accrued over 3,400 patients, is being run by Rob Coleman in England. It's called the Azure trial. And the design of that study is a comparison of adjuvant zoledronic acid given monthly for 6 months and then every 3 months for a couple of years versus placebo. And that study also, it's in higher risk patients than the adjuvant clodronate trial. We hope that that study will also report in the year 2008. There's a third study that's just begun, which is an intergroup study run by Julie Grelow, which will hopefully enroll 6,500 patients. And the design of that study will be oral adjuvant clodronate in addition to systemic therapy, or oral ibandronate, another bisphosphonate, versus zoledronic acid intravenous. So the design of that study will be a comparison of two oral bisphosphonates, an older and a newer one, versus intravenous bisphosphonates for the prevention of bone mets. And that study probably won't report till 2010 or 2011. So in the short run, we may see in 2008 positive adjuvant studies with clodronate, and it could well be that that becomes the standard therapy for the prevention of bone metastasis in addition to chemotherapy and aromatase inhibitors and hormonal therapies. We're hoping that that will occur. The field of the treatment of bone metastasis and the prevention of bone metastasis and the treatment of cancer treatment-induced bone loss, I think, is moving now into newer targets, newer treatments for bony involvement, so that the immediate candidate in the next couple of years and the exciting candidate in the next couple of years is going to be a drug called denosumab. This is an antibody against a molecule called RANK ligand. RANK ligand is produced in the bone marrow microenvironment by osteoblasts and bone marrow stromal cells. secreted into the bone marrow microenvironment by these cells and causes differentiation of hematic precursor cells to mature osteoclasts and causes increased osteoclast function. So it's something that turns on osteoclasts in the bone marrow. It's the on switch is RANK ligand. Denosumab is an antibody against RANK ligand to try to prevent this osteoclast destruction of bone by an elegant selective mechanism rather than bisphosphonates. And the preliminary studies now, phase one study of denosumab, shows that this antibody, this fully human monoclonal antibody, which is given subcutaneously, has a long half-life. It appears to be quite safe, and it completely decreases bone resorption very rapidly.
How often is it given?
It depends on the indication. The phase two study is now well underway. We actually reported the first analysis of that at 13 weeks at ASCO this year, and this week we reported the 25-week analysis at the Cancer-Induced Bone Disease meeting in San Antonio. The design of the phase two study was a head-on comparison of five doses and schedules of denosumab to traditional intravenous bisphosphonate every month. The design of that study was three doses of denosumab given sub-Q every 4 weeks, increasing dosages, versus two increasing doses every 12 weeks.
And this can be given by patients?
Sub-Q at this point. Right now it hasn't been given by patients because it's been given in the trials, but it could eventually be given by the patient sub-Q as any other subcutaneous medicine. The bottom line of the phase two trials is that all the doses of denosumab decrease bone resorption significantly, as well as bisphosphonates as measured by urine serum N-telopeptide and serum C-telopeptide. At the end of 3 months, though, it looked like there was some escape in the every 12-week dosage, and it looked like the 120 every month gave you the highest level of bone resorption, and you didn't get asymptomatic hypocalcemia that you did at 180. So the dose in the cancer population, patients with metastatic bone disease that's being carried forth, is the dose of 120 every 4 weeks in head-on comparisons in metastatic bone disease to zoledronic acid given intravenously monthly. Now, the dose in the benign indications will be less frequent. So if I'm correct, I believe the dose in the large phase 3 studies in osteoporosis, no cancer, but benign osteoporosis, with denosumab will be 60 milligrams every 6 months.
What about side effects toxicity?
So far, denosumab has been a pretty clean molecule. There don't appear to be any acute phase reactions, as you see with bisphosphonates. And we'll be submitting an ASCO abstract to that regard very shortly. There's no renal toxicity associated with this drug as there is with bisphosphonate, so you don't need to do any renal monitoring. There doesn't appear, because of the lack of acute phase reaction, there are no arthralgias, no fever. The one concern that was raised in the osteoporosis studies that Mike McClung from Portland has reported in the New England Journal is there were 6 cases of second malignancies seen in the denosumab arm. But in further analysis of that studies, there are no significant differences in infections seen with denosumab compared to placebo. And the same thing is true in the cancer studies. And in further analyses, there are no significant increase in second malignancies seen with denosumab. But that's being very carefully monitored because denosumab RANK ligand inhibition does have an effect on normal lymphocytes. But so far, it appears to be a very clean molecule.
What about ONJ?
So far, it's early. Remember that in the 3,000 patients treated with zoledronic acid, there was no osteonecrosis of the jaw seen. But in the osteoporosis experience of 8,000 patients that are getting on to 2 years, so far there's been no ONJ seen. But I think you have to be a little careful and say that it's a little bit early. The average duration of the average patient with ONJ is in the order of 3 or 4 years, 52 months in the Kathy Van Posnak's Memorial Sloan Kettering experience. So it's early, and it's being monitored carefully. Now, there is one theoretical basis on which one might hope that denosumab does not cause ONJ. Remember, we said earlier that ONJ could possibly be caused by anti-angiogenic activity of bisphosphonates. RANK ligand inhibition, RANK ligand doesn't play into angiogenesis. It's a pure osteoclast stimulator. So if the mechanism of ONJ is by the anti-angiogenic activity of bisphosphonates, one might hope that you wouldn't see it in the denosumab treatments.
Where do you think things are heading with this agent? When do you think it'll be available clinically?
Denosumab trials in osteoporosis are fully enrolled. Events for the benign indication need to take place, so you need to have enough fractures that the FDA would approve it. So I think that's probably 2 or 3 years out. In the cancer indication, there are now 4 studies that are enrolling patients. one study in breast cancer with bone mets, one study in prostate cancer with bone mets, one study in multiple myeloma, and a fourth study in prostate cancer patients with rising PSA without bone mets, a prevention study. Those studies will probably complete enrollment in 2007, and it's probably going to be another year or so till events take place. So I would guess that we're looking at 2009 or 2010 before approval of that would occur in patients with the malignant indication.
Any suggestion of the possibility of an anti-tumor effect of this agent?
Yes. The mechanism by which RANK ligand turns on osteoclasts is that it sees a receptor on the surface of osteoclast precursors called the RANK receptor. So RANK ligand hooks into the RANK receptor and turns on osteoclasts. Dr. Dougal presented some very exciting work this week with human specimens showing that a significant proportion, it was 3/4 of patients with metastatic prostate cancer in bone, those prostate cancer cells expressed the RANK receptor, as did osteoclasts. So it's very possible in the bone marrow microenvironment that RANK ligand can stimulate not only osteoclasts, but it can also stimulate the growth of prostate cancer cells directly. Now, if that's the case, inhibitor of RANK ligand, such as denosumab, might inhibit tumor cell growth directly. And with a collaborator, we're hoping to take a look at some breast cancer cells and other cancer cells in the bone marrow microenvironment to see if other cancer cells do express the RANK receptor. So, yeah, there's a very good possibility of a direct anti-tumor effect of inhibition of the RANK ligand, RANK pathway.
You know, prostate cancer, you have the PSA. Is anybody thinking about just literally a therapeutic trial to see whether it works?
Yeah. As always, your questions are right on, Neil. We're going back now into the phase 2 trials of denosumab in prostate cancer and in breast cancer, and we're going to look at PSA decline with treatment with denosumab, and we're going to look at CA2729 as a marker of direct anti-tumor effect in the breast cancer trials, but we've not yet done so, but we hope to in the next couple of months. There are some other compounds that are coming into early clinical phase testing, which are very exciting in terms of inhibition of bone metastasis from the biologic standpoint. For example, there is one company, Chugai Pharmaceuticals, that has an antibody against PTHRP, which is the mediator of osteoclast destruction in many solid tumors, especially breast cancer. That's in early phase clinical trial. A second compound, which may shortly enter clinical trial, made by a number of pharmaceutical companies, are small molecule inhibitors of cathepsin K. Osteoclasts, when they destroy the surface of bone, they destroy collagen, do so by producing cathepsin K, and cathepsin K is an active enzyme that destroys type 1 collagen fibers. So inhibitors of cathepsin K are entering clinical trials probably in the year 2007. There are other inhibitors of osteoclast mobility and migration, and maybe indeed tumor cell mobility and migration. We think that tumor cells and osteoclasts may move by using alpha V beta 3 integrins to move across the surface of bone. Now, that's an interesting, exciting target, and there are inhibitors of alpha V beta 3 integrins, which will shortly enter, I believe, into clinical trials. Another class of molecules that is going to enter clinical trials very shortly are molecules that hopefully would stimulate osteoblasts to heal in lytic lesions. We know from clinical experience in a disease like multiple myeloma or in purely lytic disease in solid tumors that the bisphosphonates may cause retardation of skeletal-related events, but they don't cause healing in the majority of cases of those lytic lesions. Now, one of the reasons that osteoblasts don't work in myeloma or they don't work in solid tumors is that they're shut off when the tumor produces a molecule called DKK1 or DKOF1. So that shuts down the osteoclast. There are inhibitors of DKK1, which will shortly enter clinical testing, which we hope will cause not only osteoclasts to prevent destruction, but will cause healing in of these lesions by replacing or returning the osteoblast function to its normal level. So we're entering an era in which there are multiple new targeted therapies, which is certainly a buzzword in oncology, targeted therapies for bony disease, and it may well be we end up as we do with chemotherapeutic agents. We use a multitude of targeted therapies to treat bone metastasis or prevent bone metastasis.
What about the issue of, I was asking you before, sort of myths or misconceptions about this whole area that you think are important to address? Or do you think most people are pretty well on board and understand what needs to be done?
No, I think that thinking back historically, when bisphosphonates began to be tested, oncologists were really pretty much in the dark in terms of bone biology. It wasn't something we learned in medical school. It wasn't something we learned in our fellowships. There were no drugs to treat bony disease. We had to learn what osteoclasts and osteoblasts were. We had to learn a lot of bone biology. In recent years, we've been educated in terms of the occurrence of bone loss. It's only in the last 2, 3, 4 years we've learned that aromatase inhibitors, as we widely use them, have significant bony effects. Same thing is true of androgen deprivation therapy. So I, for one, a number of years ago, would treat a patient with androgen deprivation therapy and didn't do bone monitoring. I just wasn't aware of it. So it's increasing awareness of these phenomena in education, which has gone on within the oncology community about bisphosphonates. And in turn, I think we are learning more and we need to educate all of us about the bone biology. So we're learning a lot about the RANK ligand RANK pathway in the last year or two. And now the language is changing once again. As we talked before, we're learning about DKK1. We're learning about osteoblast function. We're learning about PTHRP. We now have in our language vicious cycle of bone metastasis, which we didn't have before. So I think the awareness is increasing, or the need for increasing awareness within the oncology community of bone physiology, bone biology, and how our treatments affect our patients is occurring, and it's very important to do so.
You know, even though the incidence of ONJ is pretty low, I think it really has caught everybody's attention. And one of the things I hear talked about is, does every patient with metastatic bone disease need a bisphosphonate? What about the patient with very minimal bone disease?
Yes, ONJ is a terribly important occurrence. I personally think it's very important, but it's gotten a lot of more press than certain other complications, probably, as we said before, because bisphosphonates are so well tolerated otherwise. But it's certainly very important. But you raise a very, very important issue. And to the present time, all people with bone metastasis have been treated the same way. So they're all apples in the basket. But we now know from a number of the bone marker studies that have been done, so Rob Coleman, Janet Brown have published, and we published, among others, that all patients with bone metastasis are not the same. So if you go back and you look at these zoledronic acid studies, if you look at the baseline amount of bone resorption as measured by baseline urinary N-telopeptide, in all the diseases, there are different categories of patients. So as a rough summary, about a third of the patients with bone mets will present with low bone resorption. A third of the patients will present with intermediate levels of bone resorption as measured by a urinary N-telopeptide between 50 and 100. Low would be less than 50. And a third of the patients present with high bone resorption, an N-telopeptide more than 100. And surprisingly, patients with prostate cancer, blastic disease, have the highest amount of bone resorption going on. Okay, so now if you look at the incidence of skeletal-related events depending on the amount of baseline bone resorption, we find that if you have high resorption, you have double or triple the rate of SREs over ensuing years. If you have high bone resorption compared to low resorption, you have a higher incidence of progression of cancer in bone. If you have higher resorption compared to lower resorption, you have a higher fracture rate, you have a higher need for radiation therapy. And most importantly, if you take the patient who presents with an N-telopeptide higher than 100 and compare the survival of that individual to a patient who presents with an N-telopeptide less than 50, you can predict that there's 4 times the risk of death. So all patients with bone mets when they present are not the same. They're apples and oranges and pears in the basket. Now, what we don't know is we don't know if we can treat people who have low resorption with less frequent doses of bisphosphonates. So there are 2 trials that are underway to try to look at that question. The first trial is called the Optimize 2 trial. And the design of that trial is to take people who are on bisphosphonates, monthly zoledronic acid, for 9 to 12 months and randomize them to one of 3 arms. The first arm will be zoledronic acid monthly continued into the second year. Second arm will be zoledronic every 3 months into the second year, arbitrarily every 3 months. And the third arm is stop the bisphosphonate after a year and watch until they have a skeletal-related event. When they have a skeletal-related event, reinstitute the zoledronic acid at that point in time. The second study, which is more directed at your question, Neil, is run in England. This is a study which is a marker-directed therapy, and the design of that study is right from the get-go to randomize people to monthly zoledronic acid therapy as we do in one arm, and the second arm is the marker-directed therapy. So depending on the level of urinary N-telopeptide every 4 months, If the levels of resorption, the N-telopeptide is high, you would do monthly zoledronic acid. If it's intermediate, you do every 2 months zoledronic acid therapy. If it's low, if the urinary N-telopeptide is less than 50, you would give the zoledronic acid every 4 months. So it's an attempt to individualize therapy based on the markers of bone resorption.
But there's not a no treatment arm.
Not in that study. There's no treatment arm.
What about clinically right now? Again, the patient with one bone med, very low tumor burden in the bone. Is it a rational consideration to not use a bisphosphonate?
Well, we don't have any data directly to answer that question. What we do know is that even patients with no pain or even patients who have lesser burdens of disease still have skeletal-related events occurring. The question of whether you should use pain as a indicator to start bisphosphonate therapy, well, when we look back at the zoledronic acid breast cancer study and we looked at the effect of zoledronic acid in people who have bone mets and pain, there was about a 25 or 30% decrease in events over time. When we look back at those people who had bone mets and didn't have pain, there was an even greater benefit in terms of delaying skeletal-related events. So right now, in the absence of a prospective randomized study of that population, I personally would not deny bisphosphonate therapy for 2 years for that patient, although it would be a wonderful study to do, Neil.
You mentioned the issue of bone and aromatase inhibitors, which of course now is a huge clinical issue in oncology. Can you talk about where we are right now in understanding that issue?
As I've learned from listening to your tapes many times over the years, and we were involved in many of the original AI studies, going back to aminoglutethamide, fadrozole, letrozole. We did those studies first at Hershey, the phase one. AIs have taken the playing field and are widely used following chemotherapy, be it Arimidex or exemestane or Femara, letrozole, whatever your preference is. And all the AIs have been shown to affect bone detrimentally. There was an interesting study presented last year at ASCO by Rob Coleman, and he looked back at the ATAC experience, and it looked like if you start with a normal level of bone mineral density and then look over time, over the 5 years of the ATAC trial, it's very unusual for a patient to go from normal bone density into the osteoporotic range. So many of us think, well, maybe that patient may not need yearly BMD. You might be able to get away with an every other year BMD and monitor that lady as you would with any other postmenopausal woman. Anybody who starts in the osteopenic range, there the chances of worsening osteopenia or moving into the osteoporotic range are higher. And I personally would be someone who would do a yearly bone mineral density on that lady. Now, bone mineral density is not an ultimate test. It has limitations also. But we know that any bone loss to a T-score of minus 2 or lower increases the risk of fracture, and we certainly don't want to put that lady at risk. So I think the answer is increasing awareness, as we said before. Certainly, if you have a T-score of anything in the osteopenic range, that lady needs careful monitoring. And if you find out the patient's losing bone mineral density, institute treatment with an oral bisphosphonate and see if you can prevent that over the period of time. And also, I heard some data this week, Neil, and it'll be interesting to see how this turns out. It looks like the bone loss of a patient on an AI might peak at year 2 in the ATAC trial. So it may well be we need to more carefully monitor patients early on into AI therapy like we do with the normal postmenopausal woman. She'll lose most of her BMD in the first 2 to 4 years after menopause. And it may be we need to monitor more intensely in the first year or two. But right now, unless the patient has a normal BMD, we're monitoring yearly.
When you use an oral bisphosphonate, which one do you use?
I think it's dealer's choice. I think I would treat that patient like osteoporosis, either Fosamax or Actonel. I would start at this point with an oral bisphosphonate, although we're all waiting for data from the intravenous zoledronic acid therapy, whether we can use every six-month schedule. What I personally do is I'll use an oral bisphosphonate. If it's not tolerated, then you can use pimidronate every 6 months or zoledronic acid every 6 to 12 months, and I think we're waiting for the studies to define that a little more.
What were your thoughts about the Austrian study that looked at premenopausal women who got ovarian ablation plus an AI and then the bisphosphonate?
Yeah. Well, Michael Gnant in the Austrian Breast Cancer Group has done some wonderful work, as you point out, looking at GnRH agonist plus TAM or GnRH agonist plus anastrozole. And not surprisingly, they've shown significant bone loss when you shut ovarian function down with a GnRH agonist, and especially with the addition of an aromatase inhibitor such as Arimidex. Interestingly, they've shown that you can prevent bone loss in that situation with zoledronic acid, intravenous zoledronic acid. In similar fashion, Adam Brusky has shown, I believe it's been on your tapes before, Neil, with the ZFAS study, showing that upfront zoledronic acid can prevent bone loss as opposed to delayed zoledronic acid for 6 or 12 months where you lose significant amounts of BMD once you start an AI. So I think it's pretty clear across the board that either the AI in the postmenopausal woman or estrogen deprivation plus or minus an AI in the premenopausal woman is very detrimental to bone in many of the patients and needs to be monitored and treated appropriately.
One of the things that was interesting in the ovarian suppression plus tamoxifen arm was that these people lost bone. I think before I saw that, I had the feeling, well, tamoxifen is bone protective completely.
Yeah, I had that impression also, but certainly in the older days and indeed in recent time when we have an occasional patient who, for whatever reason, you don't want to use an AI on, tamoxifen doesn't protect bone in all people. I think these people need to have their bones monitored at least every 2 years on tamoxifen, and I do that. I don't do it yearly, but I've seen some people, not a lot, but I've seen some people who do continue to lose bone at a relatively expected rate, even in the face of tamoxifen. So it's a better drug in terms of bone sparing than AIs, but it's not perfect.
Of course, the original AI studies, unlike ATAC, didn't do bone mineral density monitoring or bisphosphonate intervention, which is now kind of standard. When you see a patient today whom you're going to begin on adjuvant AI, how do you counsel them? Do you tell them that there's going to be an increased fracture rate, or do you tell them the current approach is that's not very likely?
Well, I think there was some bone monitoring in the ATAC trial.
I think it was a sub-protocol.
I think Tony Howell did that as a sub-protocol. I think you're entirely right, Neil. Yeah, I think when you start talking to a patient who you would put on an AI, which is terribly common nowadays, it's almost everybody, that's certainly one of the complications that you talk about. You talk about the acute side effects of an AI, which might be arthralgias, not feeling terribly well, joint pains, muscle pains. But you certainly outline to that patient what you're going to do in terms of monitoring their bone and why you're doing it. And why you're doing it, as you rightly point out, is that all the AI studies have shown an increased bone mineral density loss and an increased fracture rate, and you need to make the patient aware of that. The clinical problem comes up when a 70-year-old lady comes to you, either plus or minus adjuvant chemotherapy, and you're selecting your hormone therapy, and we always do a BMD prior to selection of therapy, and she comes in and she's got a T-score of -3, and she's not been on any osteoporosis therapy. Well, do you use an AI on that patient, or do you use tamoxifen on the patient? Well, tamoxifen is, you and I know, Neil, is a superb drug, which was around for 25 years and was the standard until this point. And you need to then, I guess, weigh the risks, benefits of your therapy as you do with all therapies. And what's the risk of her breast cancer? What are the chances of it coming back? Do you do the switching strategy? As many times I've heard your guests on your program, pending the results of Big 98, do you give that lady who has a low risk 2 or 3 years of TAM and then switch for 2 or 3 years to an AI? Yeah, we've done that. Certainly what you don't want to do is you don't want to end up with that lady worsening her T-score, fracturing her hip, and having immobility and all the risks and problems associated with the fractured hip. So I think you need to individualize therapy. You certainly need to be aware of the risks of an AI. And yeah, there are a number of patients in whom I backed off and not given an AI because I was more concerned about her bones than I was about her breast cancer and hurting her. I think that the study of bony problems in cancer patients, be they metastatic disease or be they the complications of our therapy, are an emerging area, an exciting area. We're in its infancy, and we've got a lot of new understanding and new knowledge and new drugs coming in the next couple of years that will greatly benefit our patients in all ways and make the therapies that have been such great advances, such as the use of AI, safer for us in coming years.